the subject of the Brexit crisis, we need a written constitution. I was thinking this morning, quietly, that the conspicuous constitutional change was a great act of parliament which we passed at the beginning of the day in Cameron government to ensure that we no longer have surprise elections. Since we have two elections, we should be taking surprises. My advice to the speakers today is it's not just the writing of the constitution, but the constitution is well thought out and seems to work. But again, moving quickly on to the debate, we've got three very eminent speakers today. Lord Butler and Brockwell, Robin Butler, who was head of the civil service and also head of the cabinet office. He was private secretary of the Dean, Harold Wilson, principal private secretary of Margaret Thatcher, and also cabinet secretary during her time, John Major and Tony Blair. So he had immense experience in government at the centre. He became a master of University College in the left and has made a life here in the 1998 onset. He is going to speak first, and then we have on my left Bronwyn Maddox, who is the director of the Institute for Government, which is a leading independent think tank. From 2010 to 2016, she was the editor-in-chief and chief executive of Prospect. Prior to that, she was chief foreign commentator, foreign editor, and the US editor at the Times. She was previously with the Financial Times. She is going to speak second, and then further on my left, we have Professor Robert Hazel, who is Professor of Government and Constitution at the University College London. He founded the Constitutional Unit in 1995, which has published over 180 reports on every aspect of constitutional reform in the United Kingdom. So who better to sum up our debate today than Professor Hazel? And without more ado, they're all going to speak for about 10 minutes, and then after that, they'll be able to get to the floor. But we can ask Robin Butler to start off.
Well, Michael, thank you. Despite that very flattering write-up you gave me, I feel very diffident about this. I'm yoked with two constitutional experts. I am a mere practitioner, and a rather long-in-the-tooth practitioner as that. But so we've agreed I should go first, and then they can put me right when they speak. So, first of all, to go to my conclusion. I am opposed to trying to give Britain a so-called written constitution, but my second point, that is not to deny that there are defects in our constitutional arrangements which need attention. Our examination question, as Michael said, is the Brexit crisis. Do we need a written constitution? In other words, is there anything about the Brexit crisis which should make us feel that we now need a written constitution? And I see two aspects to that question. First, would the shambles we're in over Brexit have been avoided if we had had a written constitution? And second, does Brexit provide the moment when the UK should join the great majority of countries who have got a written constitution? On the first question, let's remind ourselves what were the aspects of the Brexit mess which might have been avoided by a written constitution. And people, I think, commonly complain about three. First, the referendum itself. Second, the inability of Parliament to implement the result of the referendum, and third, the role of the judiciary. On the referendum itself, there are widespread criticisms, mainly, I must say, from those who were disappointed by the result. First, they say, the subject was not suitable for a referendum. Secondly, they say that a higher threshold or a minimum participation should have been specified for a decision to leave. And third, they say that the franchise should have included 16 and 17-year-olds or UK citizens living abroad. Now, first question, could these problems have been avoided if a written constitution had specified the circumstances in which referendums should be held or the rules applying to them. I doubt whether it is practicable to generalise. If there are to be further referendums, which God forbid, I think it's better for Parliament to legislate specifically to suit the circumstances of each case, because each case is likely to be different. Second, Parliament's inability to implement the result of the referendum. Now, this stems from the fact that there are three possible courses: leaving without an agreement, leaving with the best agreement the government could negotiate, or not leaving at all. On each of these courses, a minority of members of Parliament are in favour, but a majority is against, and hence the impasse. I don't see how a written constitution could have prevented that situation. Now, in the good old days, before the Fixed Term Parliament Act, which Michael referred to, the Prime Minister could have made approval of the departure agreement an issue of confidence, and if Parliament defeated it, called an election. That would have been a way out of the impasse. And that just shows, Fixed Term Parliaments Act, how codifying this part of our Constitution, even with the best intentions, has actually made matters much worse. Third, the involvement of the judges. I respectfully agree with the Supreme Court that the two matters in which they have intervened in Brexit were actions of the executive, not of Parliament. Now, my career was spent under the shadow of judicial review, through which citizens can claim protection from improper or unreasonable actions of the executive. And I would not like to see judges prevented from providing such protection against an overmighty executive. So I can't see how a written constitution would have prevented the present shambles. So then I come to the second aspect of the examination question. Does the United Kingdom's departure from the EU provide the occasion when we should join the great majority of countries in the world and codify our constitution? Is this what, in his most recent book, Vernon Bogdanol calls our constitutional moment? Now, over recent years, many of our constitutional arrangements have been amended by statute and the results put in written form. Bogdanol lists 14 of them: devolution to Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, the creation of the Supreme Court, the Fixed Term Parliament Act, and others. Now, does Brexit therefore provide the occasion to pull all our constitutional laws together with the conventions which we have used into a single written code? My view is that this would be searching for fool's gold. Countries with written constitutions have generally produced them either because they are new states or following a revolution. The UK has not had such a constitutional moment since 1688. Our constitutional arrangements have evolved over the centuries and, in my view, will need to continue to do so in response to changing circumstances and the demands of our population, of which an example was the pressure for devolution. And in this, we have a very valuable advantage over the United States, where, despite the very obvious defects in their constitution, no significant amendment has been capable of passing to the United States Constitution in the last 60 years. I leave aside the question of who would be entrusted with drafting a written constitution for Britain and how it would be approved. It would take us a long time to decide those. But if we did try to do it, we would certainly make well-intentioned mistakes, as we have done with the Fixed Term Parliament Act and the abolition of the post of Lord Chancellor. At least these have not been so entrenched that we cannot put them right if we choose to do so. So I conclude that we should not be so traumatised by the muddle which is Brexit that we make things even worse, for example, by interfering with the political independence of our judges or launch what would be a futile attempt to rigidify and entrench what Lord Judge, the former Lord Chief Justice, described in a recent speech in the House of Lords as our wonderfully flexible constitution.
Thanks very much indeed. I'm also not suggesting a big bang where we go and write everything down as Afghanistan or the European Union, when first conceived, could do. But I do think that we're going to come out of Brexit with a list of problems that very urgently need addressing, and some of those by codification. Of course, quite a lot of our constitution is written down. What we're talking about here really is whether it all needs to be wrapped up into a tidy bundle and acquiring a central status in the way our country runs, where all those fundamental principles and rules get written into one document, if you like. And I don't think we're there, and we're not going there. Our history has left us with the patchwork of judicial judicial decisions, of conventions, indeed of things put into a statute and so on, and that whole bundle of things we call our constitution. The most troublesome areas, if you like, the ones that are giving us trouble at the moment at least, are the ones that are least formally treated, the powers of the executive, the legislature, the monarch, and how they all interact. And that really is the heart of what we're talking about today. This isn't a new debate. I mean, you could say it's a very, very old one. But the problems were there, and this debate was there before Brexit. Robin Bullis referred to the fluidity of our constitution. There really been quite a lot of changes, and some of those with unforeseen consequences or sitting uneasily with others. We obviously had the accession to the European Communities Act 1972, which brought its own challenge to parliamentary sovereignty, as did all kinds of international laws to which the UK subscribes. And in the last 20 years, there have been a lot of changes. And, for example, reform of the House of Lords, devolution, and so on. And you might say that these illustrate the wonderful flexibility of the UK constitution, but they have brought their own unforeseen or incomplete consequences. I remember the Saudi ambassador at the time of the reform of the House of Lords saying very dryly, if that's what Tony Blair means by democracy, getting rid of one whole House of Parliament and replacing it with his friends, we can do that tomorrow. And many people might think that an incomplete reform. On devolution, Wales certainly would start by saying, look, this was never well thought out. The Scots, who put more thought into it, had a head start. We've been playing constitutional catch-up, and many of our grievances have still to be addressed. We want more powers, and this whole thing has been done in a very patchy and untheoretical way, if you like. So post-Brexit, what are the kind of issues that are really very live that need some urgent addressing? Well, devolution is absolutely one of those. We will probably have something that we need to say about human rights and how we treat that in law. We have big questions about the parliamentary and executive powers and how those sit next to each other, and of course how the courts sit in relation to all that. What really needs to be resolved? What's the most urgent? I would actually put devolution at the top of that list. I think the strains in the union that Brexit has revealed and added to are immense, and we're heading down a path for the disintegration of the union if these grievances and constitutional asymmetries and an unthought-out areas of governance are not addressed very quickly. The Fixed-Term Parliaments Act has gone from almost entire obscurity to being something that half the population is expert on, as well as being able to spell things like pirogue, hitting the top of Google searches. The Fixed-Term Parliaments Act, as Lord Butler was saying, was conceived with very good intentions of removing part of government's power to call elections at a time to suit itself. Yes, it was intended to prop up the coalition, but the spirit was honourable and indeed would have brought us, or did bring us into line with other countries. The fact that it has that circumstances exist under that Act where a deadlock of the kind we're seeing at the moment is possible, where the government wants an election and cannot have one, that can be addressed by reform of that Act. But that's not the same thing as a case for throwing it entirely out the window and returning to the previous state of convention. And we may, in fact, have to think much more carefully about rules on government formation and the period of government formation if we head for a period of more minority governments. A lot of what we're seeing now in Parliament is not the result of Brexit or of a very divided country, but is the result of minority government. And much of the scrapping between Parliament and the executive is over powers that would be essentially irrelevant if there were a majority government. So if we had, as seems very plausible to a lot of people, for a spell of minority governments, or in fact perhaps a future of minority governments, then we will have to address some of those things. We also need to look at things, I think, like the role of the Attorney General and so on. But what of this needs codifying and what doesn't? Well, in what doesn't, I would put parliamentary procedure, where I think the principle that Parliament sorts out its own rules still stands. And as I said, things like role of the Speaker, when Parliament has the right to extract information from the government, and who has control of the order paper. For the moment, these are things that we can leave for Parliament to sort out unless it demonstrates over a long period of time that it really can't. I'd also put in the don't codify it, the independence of the civil service, which is addressed in the Cabinet Manual, and indeed the style in which the monarch conducts the job. These are all things which are not without debate, but basically, but not broken to the point of needing codification. But some of the things that do, I would begin with devolution, and I would consider as well some of the questions about the powers of the executive, and we've begun to see that already with prorogation and the debate about that. We have to do this incrementally. No one is on for a big bang, and it would be very, very hard to get public support for that. If Brexit has been divisive, then a constitutional commission or something like that would burn up the decades, I think, without obvious product. The counter-arguments to doing anything, well, rigidity, but as Lord Butler mentioned, but we have actually quite a lot of rigidity in there. It's not obvious to many people that devolution actually could be reversed. And the big one really is parliamentary sovereignty. Should anything come above Parliament? Parliamentary sovereignty isn't as pure a concept. It's an important one in our constitution, probably is the central one, but it's not as pure a concept as its advocates would have us say. As I said, there are incursions onto it from many sides, and it has to sit along the other things that make our constitution work. So, my conclusion, I'm not a purist on this. I'm absolutely not heading for a grand UK constitution, and I don't think we could get one even if we wanted it, even if I was standing here and thought the case were absolutely compelling. But we're going to come out of Brexit with some really urgent problems in our constitutional arrangements, and some of those are best addressed by codification. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman, for the invitation, and thank you, everyone, for coming today. Do we need a written constitution? As you will all know, our constitution is largely written. It's simply not codified. It's not been brought together in a single document. And like the previous speakers, I too don't think that we need to codify our constitution. For anyone who wants to... Is that better? Sorry, those who couldn't hear me. Is that better now? Like that? Very good. For anyone who wants to read the conventions of the British Constitution, they have been codified in the Cabinet Manual of 2011, a document published by the Cabinet Office. For those of you who don't know it, I commend it to all of you. It's a very good summary of how the British Constitution and the system of government works. But I don't want to sound complacent. We're clearly in a deep political crisis, but I don't think it's a constitutional crisis. The Constitution has certainly been tested severely, but I don't think it's broken. Our parliamentary system is working in very difficult circumstances. Members of Parliament in particular are doing their best in extremely difficult circumstances, and I think it's really unfortunate and damaging to depict the Brexit struggles as the people versus Parliament. That risks undermining the central institution in our democracy. But, like the previous speakers, I think there are serious weaknesses in our political system. Let me mention just three. First, because it's topical, the Fixed Term Parliaments Act. It's been heavily criticised. It's been blamed for a zombie parliament. And it's been a major scapegoat for difficulties which, as I shall explain in a moment, I think are largely of the government's own making. The Act is relatively new. It may certainly need some fine-tuning. But I support the principles of fixed terms. Most other countries have them, including in the Westminster world. And crucially, fixed terms end the unfairness of the government itself choosing the date of the next election. But our legislators were wise when they passed the Fixed Term Parliament Act in 2011. They provided in the last section of the Act for a statutory review after 10 years. And that review, therefore, must start next year. And indeed, the Constitution Committee in the House of Lords has already begun an inquiry. And I was one of the first witnesses to give evidence to that inquiry. I said there are three things which might need fixing. Let me mention just the last two in the interest of time. Most important, again relevant today, is the two-thirds required for dissolution other than by a vote of no confidence. That's a high threshold by international and comparative standards. We did a report on fixed-term parliament legislation 10 years ago, which included looking at 16 other European countries. And of those that have provision for what I will call voluntary dissolution, i.e. dissolution by a vote of the members, not by a vote of no confidence, the threshold in half of them was a simple or absolute majority. No other country has a heightened majority like the two-thirds requirement. A second criticism I'd make of the Act, which again has been pertinent to recent debates, is that if there is a dissolution under the Act, it leaves it to the Prime Minister to choose the date of the next election. He advises the Queen, who then announces it by proclamation. And I think that Parliament should choose, or there should be some mechanism to ensure at least cross-party support for the chosen date for the next election. Second weakness in our political system is our majoritarian political culture, which results from our first-past-the-post electoral system, which tends to create a dominant two-party system. That's been the norm in my lifetime, the 70 years since the Second World War, when we've seen a single party win an overall majority in the House of Commons, often with very comfortable majorities. It's a winner-takes-all system. And it tends to lead the governing party to take very little notice of the opposition or the other parties in Parliament, simply because they don't have to. We all know it's very different when you have coalition or minority government, as all of you from other countries in Europe will know very well from your own experience. We wrote a report, again 10 years ago, titled Making Minority Government Work, published jointly with Bronwyn Malik's Institute for Government. And in that report, we said that rule one of effective minority government is don't try to govern in a majoritarian way. By that, we meant recognise from the start that you'll need the support of other parties to get your business through Parliament. And to gain that support, you need to reach out and to compromise. But just look at how Theresa May operated when she became Prime Minister, and look now at Boris Johnson. Both, I'm afraid, epitomise the majoritarian approach of Westminster politicians. Now, I've been agnostic in the past about proportional representation, but I'm beginning to wonder whether we wouldn't benefit from a change. It would be a painful transition. It might take a whole new generation of politicians to learn the rules of a new political game. But another reason for going on thinking about our electoral system is that first past the post tends to work increasingly chaotically and unpredictably when a two-party system starts to fragment into a multi-party system, which is what we're beginning to see now. Third weakness in our system is referendums. And this, to my mind, is the biggest weakness. There's no consensus about what the place of referendums should be in our political system. We hear an awful lot about the people's will and the 17.4 million who voted to leave. Should their views trump everyone else? Again, that's a simple majoritarian view. There's a head-on clash at the moment between popular sovereignty and parliamentary sovereignty. What should the balance be between direct democracy through referendums and representative democracy through our representatives in Parliament? Well, after the Brexit referendum, we set up an independent commission on referendums to consider that question, and it reported last summer. It was a cross-party commission with an even balance between Leavers and Remainers, and let me highlight for you just three things which the commission said in their report. First, it's naive to suppose that we will never again have a referendum. Already there are three possible referendums in prospect. A second Brexit referendum, that may be receding. A second independence referendum in Scotland, as Bronwyn hinted, that may be coming up on the outside. And third, and little discussed, the possibility of a border poll in Northern Ireland, whereby the people of Northern Ireland might be asked to vote in whether they would like to reunify with the people in the Republic of Ireland. Second point made by the Commission is, given that we are likely to have more referendums, we should strive to ensure that never again do we hold a bluff call referendum, or one which is a leap in the dark. Government should only hold referendums when they support the change that's being put, and they should publish a detailed white paper setting out the consequences of the change, as happened, for example, with the devolution referendums in 1997. And in future, we should try to include more deliberative democracy in any future exercises in direct democracy. A good example would be the recent referendums held in Ireland, the ones on same-sex marriage and on legalising abortion. Both were preceded by citizens' assemblies, which heard evidence from experts, deliberated, and then published reports, which helped the government then to craft the details of the scheme. In my last minute, let me make one final point about a written constitution, which is about the practicalities of trying to codify a constitution. How would we set about drafting a codified constitution, and what would it say? Would it be purely descriptive, codifying the constitution as is, or would it be prescriptive, allowing people to propose reforms and improvements? And it would be very hard to prevent it sliding into the latter. There's a risk of it then becoming enormously prolonged, even possibly longer than Brexit, and a terrible distraction from what Tony Benn used to call the real issues. Thank you very much.